It's haunting. It's lyrical. It's the After the Buzzer theme. That's the first, that's its debut. And playing us in, what do you think we got?
I think I feel like I'm on Mannix back in the 70s.
Yeah, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for a retro vibe, and there it is. It's After the Buzzer. It's Gordy Jones and Mike Gross hanging. And our guest is a basketball storyteller. That's what we're looking for this time of year.
Absolutely.
He's also a diplomat, which does not mean he has any role in foreign policy whatsoever.
not that we know of.
He's a Franklin and Marshall diplomat. And he's also a talk show host in the Bay Area for the flagship station of the Golden State Warriors, with whom he has had a long journalistic association. Yep. And as I suggested, he's a Berks County guy, a Franklin and Marshall guy. We're going to talk about some of his writing that harkens back to the old days. Matt, I love the fact that you did a blog post that had Martz Hall, Hershey Park Arena, and Oracle Arena on the same list. Well done.
I appreciate that. Well, but you know what's funny is I was talking about this to my partner the other day, and we were just talking about, you know, the greatest sports environments.
Right, yeah.
All levels, all sports. Mm-hmm. And once I started thinking about it, you know, to me, there's never been anything that has matched high school basketball at Hershey or the Farm Show or Martz Hall or Geigel Complex.
Yeah.
And I tell people out here, you got to understand, they had doubleheaders at Hershey Park Arena, high school doubleheaders, where, you know, 8,000-9,000 people would be there. Yeah. And it was just incredible. Just incredible, incredible environments. Yeah. And, you know, the only thing that's ever reminded me a little bit of that was when the Warriors went to the playoffs in 2007 out of nowhere. They kind of caught some lightning in a bottle, and it was very organic, and it was unbelievable. Mm. But as far as high school sports back in Pennsylvania, those were the best environments I've ever been involved in as a fan, for sure.
And unfortunately, they're not putting 8,000 people in these buildings for high school hoops anymore. That's kind of sad for a lot of reasons.
Right.
But the Geigel and Martz Hall are still great. And of course, have you been in the Giant Center at Hershey?
No, in fact, so it's a different building entirely than the Hershey Park Arena?
Yes, yeah. It is. Yeah. It's a modern arena that seats like 10,000.
It's where the Bears play.
So they built it right next to it? Did they build it
adjacent to it? It's close. It's
nearby. Really, if you can picture where the stadium is, it's a little bit west of this, a little bit west of the stadium.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right on that sort of.
They don't
play the Big 33 game there either, do they?
They don't play that. They play that. The Big 33 game has really gone to shit. to put it bluntly, it's a big part of it is so many of the blue chip kids enrolling early.
Yeah.
So they're just not available in the summer. That's a huge part of it. That is really a small fraction of what it used to be. They actually play it at Central Dolphin High School the last couple of years.
Which,
it's not what it once was.
Yeah. It's a shame, actually.
Yeah. So, that used to be a really big deal. What's wrong with this Golden State Warrior basketball team, Matt? What do you think?
Well, I think it's a combination of a lot of different things. Mm. We spent most of the show today talking about it. I really think that, you know, the biggest issue is they are getting older. I mean, they just are. Yeah. And even though Curry's still playing at a very high level, and Thompson's been pretty good shooting the ball, and Draymond's still pretty good when he's good, there's been slippage. There's just been slippage, and it's been most noticeable on the defensive end.
Yeah.
They're giving up a ton of points, and they foul a lot. And to me, the fouling is a product of kind of their age.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the Warriors, in years past, you know, their defense was incredible. Steph Curry was defending the one, and he got to be adequate as a defender, even though he guarded the two. So they had Klay Thompson, who could guard ones and was a terrific two-way player.
Yeah.
They had Draymond Green. They had Iguodala. So they had, they could switch everything, and even though they were considered small, and this is even with Durant, they still were big in every position other than center. So, you know, they switched everything, and now they just, you just lose a half step, and, and that's the difference. People say, well, they won it 9 months ago. Well, it's the same team. Well, you know what? I mean, in the NBA, 9 months is a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing I remember is, let's go back to the 80s with Celtics and the Lakers. If back then, I remember, it was almost a theme. If you wanted to win, go back-to-back, the big thing you talked about is, well, man, winning it last year took a lot out of them, and now they played into June, so now they're going to have to come back, play another season, and play into June again. Well, that's exactly what the Warriors are trying to do, but their core is on the downside. So it's they're really asking a lot of this team, not just the veterans, but then the young guys, some of whom aren't quite ready.
Yeah, it might be that 5 years from now we'll look back at last year and think that was the weird thing. That was the amazing thing that they won that. Yeah.
I actually agree with you. It's a little tricky thing to say out here because you're not saying they're lucky. I'm not saying they were lucky.
No.
But
no.
Like every champion, they had some good fortune.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if they play the Celtics this year, the Celtics beat them because they lost to them last year.
Yeah.
You know, they got to play Denver when Denver didn't have a shot at it. John Morant got hurt. Then they should have played Phoenix, but you know, they got upset, and then Dallas became a much more favorable matchup for the Warriors.
Yeah.
But, like, that's the part, again, I'm not saying they were lucky, but they got some breaks last year, but nobody's accounting for the fact that they might have gotten some breaks last year. Everybody just says, well, they're championship pedigree, and they'll be it again, without kind of acknowledging, you know, some things went their way last year, one of which was everybody got healthy at the right time. Yeah.
I wonder how much of a factor the Draymond Jordan Poole incident from preseason played in team chemistry.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's bigger than the punch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's and we've been talking about it for the last 3 or 4 days, there's a disconnect on this team.
Mm-hmm.
Between the veterans and the championship guys and the young guys.
Mm-hmm.
There's just, you know, the veterans, I don't think, feel like the kids have paid their dues.
Mm-hmm.
And even a player like Jordan Poole, who helped them a lot last year, I don't think they're crazy about his game.
Mm-hmm.
I think there might be some resentment that he got paid.
Mm.
You know, like, he's going to make more money next year than Draymond Green made in any year in his NBA career. And, you know, there's just, you know, Bob Myers. It's one of those things where it's like, I kind of feel like it's just one of those years where it's just not going to happen for him.
That's pretty clear.
I don't even know if their general manager, Bob Myers, is coming back. He doesn't have a contract for next year.
Yeah, that's right.
Draymond may opt out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So there's a lot going on with this team.
And the thing that one of the things Mike and I were talking about before we started was just how their road. They're 27-7 at home and 7-25 on the road. I mean, that's
what's
incredible.
What's that about? Is that anything that you can diagnose, man?
I think it's a combination of the veterans. You know, they put a lot of effort into last year. Like, they started out 18-2 because they hadn't won the previous 2 years. So I think they wanted to prove something. Then they end up winning it. And I just think they're like, oh, my God, is it going to be tough to play a regular season now?
Mm-hmm.
Again, because of their age. And I just think their young guys don't quite get it. And then their old guys aren't who they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were so good, they could kind of coast even on the road.
Mm-hmm.
Put together 1.5, 2 good quarters, and they usually were going to win. They just do not have that margin for error because they just don't defend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even when they were on the road on their good teams, they always knew if they needed to get stops, they could.
Mm-hmm.
They just can't get stops right now.
Mm-hmm.
Matt, people are, you know, the Philadelphia market for talk radio is pretty insane. And I'm sure that there are people in the Philly market who would think, what, the Bay Area talk radio? Are you kidding me? I mean, what are your, what's your audience like? Are they, I imagine this, the bar has gotten, their standards have gotten pretty high for this team, but what's your sense of what your audience would be like compared to maybe what we're used to here in the Northeast and the big metros here?
Yeah, to me, the Warriors have kind of old school fans, and those are the guys my age, basically my age, and I don't have to say the number. Well, they were here when the Warriors went, you know, they went 12 straight years without making the playoffs. And they really hadn't had any success after 70 title. And so there's that generation my age, and I think they are just, like, they're on cloud nine. And they're smart enough to know that everything comes in cycles and that this thing's probably coming to an end. There's another group of fans, and I think, generally speaking, they're a little younger. I mean, they feel entitled. They absolutely feel entitled. They think here's my thing out here. They think, oh, you guys are right. Like, I don't think the Warriors are going to win it this year. There's just too much going against them.
Right.
Those kind of Warrior fans think, you know what? You don't understand. These guys are champions. These guys are this. They'll turn it on. Mm. They're just waiting. All that stuff. And you must give the Warriors that respect. You have to.
Yeah.
But what I try to tell people is that what they're trying to do this year is virtually unprecedented. They're actually trying to win back-to-back titles on the back end of a dynasty.
Mm.
That's, like, really hard. Really hard.
That's a
and
good
so,
point. Yeah.
Like, what I've been trying to emphasize to people is, like, you guys think it's easy. Like, I almost get the feeling if the Warriors win it this year, half the fans are going to be like, yeah, no big deal. And I'm telling them, no, if they win it this year, guys, it's one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen in the NBA.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is there will have been 9 years, 8 or 9 years between first title and last title, but essentially the core three guys are the same. And even if you want to throw Iguodala in there, even if he's not playing, but like every iteration of a dynasty, you know, Spurs got Kawhi to come in there. Robinson was part of the first one, and then Tim Duncan and the guys did, and then Kawhi really helped them get that last one. To me, if the Warriors win it, and I know Wiggins is it, but to me, if the Warriors win it, it means their three most important players in 2015 were Draymond, Steph, and Clay, and if they win it this year, 8, 9 years later, their three most important players are going to be the same guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Like, even Bill Russell, who was there from the start to the finish, had guys coming in and out over his career.
No doubt.
So, it would be spectacular if they could pull this off.
And yet, you were talking about that long period of time where they were not relevant. But people were still going to the games, right? That's one of the things that is a little bit unique about that franchise, right?
Yeah, the Bay Area is a really good basketball, you know what, a pro basketball town. We don't, like these guys, we could care less about Stanford and about Cal, St. Mary's. Like, they just don't move the needle with grown-ups here, you know, outside the students.
Yeah.
And even high school basketball, it's like, it's good. It's really good, and it should be more popular because a lot of good players come out of here.
Yeah, right.
But for some reason, it's all about the Warriors. And even when the Warriors weren't very good, because they were playing in Oakland, which is a gritty, town and an underdog town, they still embraced the team even though they lost. And so they even came out during those lean years. And then, obviously, they started winning titles in Oakland. And, it really, really blew up at that point. And now they're in San Francisco. And the dynamic's not much different, to tell you the truth. But this area does like pro basketball. There's no doubt about it.
I wanted to return for a minute just to some of the things you wrote on your blog about people a wide variety of basketball fans have heard of and some that they have not. I thought there was a nostalgic feel to it. There was an insight to it. You mentioned a guy named Neil Crystal from back in Berks County.
Yeah.
You mentioned.
Saw him play.
You see. You mentioned Tony Bonanno, a guy I remember seeing up. Speaking of Hershey, I saw him play up there.
Yeah.
But let's start here with Glenn Robinson, a guy that would be familiar to a lot of our listeners. And I thought that was interesting what you said about how he kind of walked the line. He gave you guys freedom as players, but he also had some guidelines that you had to work within. And the two that frustrated you as a point guard were the fact that you always had to be the first guy on back on defense, no matter if you were splattered on the apron or not. And a bad pass was always the passer's fault. I wonder if you could expound on those. And because I know we've talked on other occasions how you and Glenn were, you know, at loggerheads on occasion.
Yeah.
So I wonder if
you know, back then, I don't even know if it's, you know, they had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. One was a point guard, 2 was a shooting guard, 3 small forward, 4 power forward, 5 center. And Glenn just had a rule.
Mm-hmm.
The one guy is the first one back. If they get a 1-on-0 break, that's your fault.
Oh, my gosh.
1, period. End of story. Like, right. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. If it was a 2-on-1... then it was Talbert's fault or Bastion's fault. If it was a 3-on-2, then it was whoever was playing 3 for us. But in a little way, it dissuaded you from penetrating, because if you didn't finish,
right?
I mean, you better somehow find a way to still be the first one back. And Glenn would hold you accountable.
Yeah.
So it's not like, oh, well, he got mad because you didn't get back. No. He might take you out of the game because you didn't get back. And then as far as the passing, I could hit a guy right in the hands with a pass, and if he dropped it,
mm-hmm.
it became a joke between me and my teammates. Like, we'd be at practice, and I'd hit a guy with a good pass, and he'd drop it, and everybody'd start running up the other way. Pass is fault. Sign, it's your fault. Sign, it's your fault. And I kind of started laughing about it after a while, but Glenn was a big kind of know your personnel,
uh-huh.
And it was always the passer's fault, and that just, God, that bothered me. It really bothered me. That wasn't as hard clad as the get, like, you didn't get back as a one man, he would take you out of the game.
Yeah.
Now, if you hit a center on the hands and he drops it, he wouldn't take you out of the game for that,
mm-hmm.
but you know, in his mind, you turned it over, we turned it over with you on the floor making that decision.
I just remember in general, Glenn always had a real interesting quote-unquote relationship with his point guards. How did it evolve between you and him?
It evolved after I graduated. I grew up a little bit. I mean, quite frankly, classic case of I was a pain when I was younger.
Right.
I wasn't the great, I didn't take his kind of coaching great, because he did have some rules and stuff, but, it's one of those things where, when I 25, 30, 35, 40, now 50, it's like, you know, you realize he was a great coach. I mean, an absolutely great coach, and he never gave in to me, mm-hmm. ever. And I needed that back then. Mm-hmm. I really did. And yet, like, as rigid as he was, you know, he also, like, he was consistent in that, you know, he ran that North Carolina offense, which gives you a lot of freedom.
Yeah. Right.
But there are certain rules. If you pass, you got to screen away. You can't stay in the low post for more than a count or two before you got to screen to the other side. You know, moving away from all that stuff, you had a lot of freedom, but there were a few things you had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's, like, who Glenn kind of was, I think, because, you know, we did have our moments where we weren't on the same page, but, like, he never, like, he'd always bring me back, or he'd always, like, it was where, you know what, Matt, you and I are just not on the same page, and I'm just going to forget about you. Like, he always, we had our thing, and then it was over.
Yeah.
And he never held it against me long term. And he, like, the one thing he always said was, like, you know, the one thing, you and me, we hate to lose. And that's one of the reasons we don't get along, is because you're really competitive, and so am I, and you don't like the way I am. You know, he was right about all that stuff.
Hmm. I didn't even, until I read this piece about Glenn, Matt, I didn't even realize that you played for Lloyd Wolfe in high school. And I got a kick out of your, where you wrote that, comparing Lloyd and Glenn, where Glenn never drank or smoked or swore, and Lloyd did all three. And I sort of remember him, but didn't know him well. Tell us about that guy a little bit, because it was obvious that he was a character. Yeah.
Oh, man, yeah. Well, he passed a few years back.
Right.
He was the total opposite of Robinson. Off the court, I mean, he drank, he smoked, he swore. I mean, you know, he kind of did all that. But as a coach, he was definitely more of a motivated. Like, I think Glenn was great preparation. I think Glenn was really good execution. I think he was good scouting the other teams. You know, to me, Lloyd Wolfe was a little bit more of a motivator than a tactician, but he did have a way of you know, really getting you ready to play and getting you, you know, at that level.
Yeah.
And Lloyd gave, you know, sometimes Glenn could take away a little bit of your confidence. Lloyd was the other way, where he would. You always knew he was in your corner and he believed in you. Glenn, I wasn't sure at times until it was all said and done and realized kind of the method to his madness. But, you know, Lloyd, I mean, that's another thing, though, that I was thinking about. Man, I played for two coaches who have like 1,500 wins between them.
Yeah.
And in fact, Steve Rossignoli was another guy I wrote about. He went to Reading High.
I remember him.
Yeah, he played for Jim Gannot, who to me is the greatest coach that nobody's ever heard of.
And
he played for Phelan at Mount St. Mary's.
Right.
So, just started thinking about all. The thing with the blog is, you know, everybody's like, you should write a book. And I'm like, about this. Six hours at a time and writing, and I gotta have it organized, and I'm like, I just can't. Like,
it's hard.
I'll get started and I'll think, nobody cares about what you're writing about here. And so I just kind of started thinking about taking it in little small things, and instead, like, I stopped kind of writing for myself, and I'm writing for the people who are reading it now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just kind of getting a kick out of how, you know, some of the people who are reading about themselves enjoy it, and like, I'm getting enjoyment out of that.
Yeah.
So, and you know what? It's like a news. Each one's like a newspaper article.
Well, yeah.
Maybe if you add them all up in 3 years, it'll be a book. But that's just kind of the way I'm going about it right now, and that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think they all read really well. I think they have a nostalgic feel. There's some coming of age stuff in there, like. Like when Rick Binder sent you the note about going down to a neighborhood you might not necessarily go play in. I really loved that vignette. I really did. Like that, he wrote
Thank
to
you.
Yeah, he wrote how that's when he knew you were going to be a good player, because you weren't afraid to go play against the black kids in their neighborhood. That's a pretty a compelling vignette, I think.
What was Binder's
Matt?
What was Binder's connection to you? What?
He was the coach at Reading High when we beat him my senior year.
Oh, okay. So he played against you. Yeah.
Yeah. He succeeded Jim Gannot.
Yeah.
So he became the Reading coach when I was a junior. And, you know, my dad was also a basketball official.
Right, I remember.
So I used to go to all his games growing up. And, like, I kind of knew all the coaches by the time I got to 9th and 10th grade, because I'd take the ball and shoot around during timeouts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, and I went to basketball camps, and they would always have the coaches from the you know, Rick Binder would work it, or, you know, Pete Carrill used to run a camp here in Albright in Reading that I'd always go to.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny, the old thing, like, something's happened over the last couple of years where I'm just really, you know, remembering,
you
know, growing up and how important basketball was, and it was really special. It was special in Reading and Lancaster and Harrisburg and District 3, man. I mean, it was, you know, I might write about Jack Hurd next. I don't know.
Yeah, you should. You should.
But maybe West McFadden.
Oh, there you go. So tell me, what was it like the first time you went down to 3rd and Spruce? You were still pretty young.
Yeah, and in fact, like, no kid would ever be able to go make that walk now. But I'd take my ball. So my dad would rep at Southwest, and the playground was about two blocks away, and he would be repping City League games at night. And I, you know, I would be like, usually I'd just stay there and shoot around during timeouts, but I knew there was this playground just a block or two away, so as soon as we got to Southwest, I just went to the playground. And I don't know, it was, yeah, all the kids were black, but they were black, and we were just playing basketball, and it was, you know, there was nothing, there was no, I mean, yeah, I was white, but there was no acrimony or danger that I felt. Yeah. You know what I mean? It was just, I got to show these guys that I can play. And you know, it's always, thank God I did, because, you know, I mean, you can't, I mean, if you can't play against black guys, you ain't any good. Is that simple?
That's very true.
That's true.
I wanted to be, better. So, you know, like, if I didn't do, never beat Reading High. You know, we don't beat Millersville. You know, 3rd and Spruce when I'm 9 years old.
That's pretty cool. I mean, it's great that you did it. I mean, not a lot of people would do that.
Mac,
no, I didn't know any better.
Well, sure. That's a lot of, that's the origin of a lot of great things. You didn't know any better. Yeah. And Matt, I think about this a lot with my own life and career and everything. You know, how many people were better players than you but didn't get to spend their whole life around the game the way you have? I mean, it's sort of like extreme good fortune, you know? I mean, do you ever reflect on that?
Yeah, my whole life's been basketball. My entire life. When I was 8 years old, I would go with my dad. Whether it was high school, you know, that was Monday night. That was high school girls. Tuesday was high school boys. Wednesday was city league or college, the Division III game. Thursday was high school girls. Friday was high school boys. And Saturday was usually a college game. So he had a rule. I'm leaving at a certain time. If you're here and you want to go, we'll go. If you're not here, I'm leaving without you. And I just always went. I was always there. I followed him around. Saw all the players I could, and you know, I was a way to spend time with my dad. And I don't know why, but I just, there was something about basketball that just, you know, even after I graduated from FNM, I had no clue what I was going to do. My grades weren't very good, but I was like, I got to do something basketball/sports related. And, you know, luckily both my parents were English teachers, so I could write a little bit, and that's how it started.
That's cool.
That's great.
Sounds good.
Totally. Totally.
So this is a discussion we had several years ago, and you finally gave me the background for this. I was like, you said something negative about Julius Erving on Twitter, and I'm like, who doesn't like Julius Erving? But you kind of explained that in this blog, that it goes all the way back to when you were 13 and went to a Sixers Jazz game in the Spectrum. You went up on the concourse to get a soda, and describe what happened next.
So this was, I think I actually, you know what, it's funny, I actually went up and looked in Basketball Reference, and I'm pretty sure I found the exact game. I remember the Jazz
with Chuck Robinson.
They were the New Orleans Jazz at the point, right? And they had Leonard Truck Robinson. Remember him?
Yes, of course.
So anyway, my dad gives me $5 to go get a soda. I'm walking on the concourse, and I notice that the Sixer wives have a booth set up Mm-hmm. I can't remember if it was for muscular dystrophy or MS, mm-hmm. but a woman says, excuse me, would you like to help? And I was like, what? And she's like, would you like to donate? You know, they were raising money. And I walked up, and she had a name tag on that said Turquoise Irvin. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I only have $5. And she's like, well, everything helps.
Right.
And I said, well, I'll tell you what. How about I'll give you the $5 if you get me your husband's autograph? So she said, okay. And the way I tell the story is she took 3408 Eisenhower Avenue, Riverview Park, Redding, PA, gave it to her on a slip of paper, and it's now 2023, and I still have not gotten that autograph. So from that day on, I couldn't stand her.
Hell with Dr. Bid. Hell with that guy.
And the postscript was when you worked camp when the Sixers were at F&M.
Right.
Go ahead. Tell that story. Tell the rest of the story.
So the Sixers would train at F&M, and we'd sometimes work. The basketball team could work and mop up. You know, we'd stand under the basket and mop up.
Right.
You know, you'd see Irving around, and like everybody at F&M when the Sixers were there,
right,
was like starstruck, and I was too. And I remember Barkley being there, and Leon Wood, and all those guys, but I just never said a word to Julius Irving. It was like I remember walking by him down in the pit, and he was walking toward me, and I'm sure he was waiting. I just walked right by him. I didn't say a word.
That'll show him.
Yeah, exactly. I snubbed him like Kramer at the fruit stand.
It always comes back to that. Always comes back to Seinfeld.
Yeah.
I think one of my favorite entries was when you talked about Don Nelson and Patrick O'Brien and Kostas Petrovic, which is, I consider myself an NBA follower. That name is completely foreign to me in every way. And how Nelly told Larry Riley to put the big stiff in, and he went to put Patrick O'Brien in, and he said, no, the white stiff.
Exactly. So the Warriors had these two big guys, both real young, at the end of the bench. Patrick O'Brien was a black guy. I think he went to Dayton. No, not Dayton. I forget where he went. And then they had another guy that they drafted from overseas, Kostas Petrovic. He was young. Somebody got into foul trouble, and Don Nelson never used to put the guys in himself. He would tell the assistant coach to do it. So he'd say, Larry, let's go. Got to put the big stiff in. Well, Patrick O'Brien was the guy who'd been playing most of the time.
Right.
So Larry Riley goes, Patrick. And Patrick gets up, and Don Nelson says, one, beating Kostas Petrovic. And that was one of seven games Petrovic played his entire career.
Yeah, that's
actually the first game he ever played.
How about
that? So
that's
why Riley just assumed it was O'Brien.
That's just great stuff. I love that. These are just all of these really kind of speak to me. I think basketball fans on some level, but whether you're familiar with the players or not, or the personalities that you mentioned, I think these are really well done.
So let's go ahead.
Let me throw a couple at you first.
Okay.
All right, so when Sam Bowie was in Lebanon, there's a game I remember. I could have sworn it was at Martz Hall against Williamsport, where he had 48.
Yeah.
And I want to say he had like 12 dunks. He was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And then I remember a game at the farm show where I want to say they had a guard named Tab Bickle.
Yep.
Yeah, he was very good. He was a tough guy.
He got hurt. And they were like, they'll take him off in a stretcher, but as they're taking him off, he like raises his fist.
Yeah, I'm number
like
one.
He's okay.
He's number one.
Yeah. Something like that. And I remember they also had, what's his name? He was a great quarterback.
John Lebo.
So I remember all those Lebanon teams.
Yeah.
And in fact, like to this day, I'll never forget watching Lebanon at Hershey Park Arena on the floor.
Yeah.
There was Joe B. Hall.
Right.
Because he was watching. And I was like, God.
Yeah.
Look, Joe B. Hall came up from Kentucky to see Sam Bowie. And Bowie was, God. Yeah. I mean, because he was, I think he was on the team as a ninth grader, but just got better and better and every year.
Yeah, the junior year was the junior year was the year when they really came together as a team, and that's when they went to the state finals and lost by one to Pittsburgh Shenley. And in the semifinal, they played Steel High, and Sam got ejected from the game for a second hanging on the rim technical
after
a dunk.
That's right.
And they won going away anyway.
That's right.
That would have been a good team.
Everybody thought they were done.
Yeah. If you take Sam off of that team and replace him with, say, a 6'4", 6'5", guy that was a really solid high school center, that would have been a terrific high school team even without him. Now, I'm not saying Sam wasn't great. He was. But they had some really nice pieces around him. And guys that I know, guys that I see at the gym. I mean, I live in Lebanon, so. Yeah, that's they are still fondly remembered.
Yeah, as they
even though they never got a big trophy.
Right. Wasn't there a game? Was it state final or was it a fight? Sam Bowie got in a fight?
No, but the state final was crazy time for a number of reasons. There was some stuff going on in the crowd. What's that?
Yeah. And I almost feel like somebody threw Sam Bowie down. And
they were a busy, big physical team.
Oh, that wasn't in the state final. Yeah, I remember that happening. Yeah, that did happen. Oh, boy, I just wrote a long piece about this for Del Jackson's book, and I can't remember. I can't remember when that, but that wasn't the state final. But the state final, there was some wild, there were some late arriving Shenley fans. There was no place for them to sit. So they gave them like folding chairs on the baseline.
Well, what could go wrong there?
And then, so they're on the, and then many of them did not stand up for the anthem.
Oh, great.
So these people from Lebanon are banging on the hockey glass and going nuts, you know. It was a very charged situation. I was in college then, but I can remember that like it was yesterday. My dad, it was right at the beginning of spring break, and my dad went out to IUP and got me and drove me. We drove straight. I think we stopped at home and hugged Mom, and then we went right to the Hershey Park Arena. Yeah, that's crazy.
I mean, I tell you know that was our Reading High was my pro team growing up. I mean, they were incredible. You know, people like out here what I tell them is, this is the one thing. Like I wrote this too. You know, growing up, watching Reading High basketball, where Kirill coached and did it, like, I never had any preconceived notions about black inner-city teams. Because the black inner-city team that I thought was more disciplined than the teams they played was more fundamentally sound than the other team, was more unselfish than the other team. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they used to have those shirts. Reading High, where basketball is beautiful. And it was just, it was incredible. There was never anything like it.
Do you remember, Matt, now we're really rolling down the memory lane here, but do you remember, this would have been Bowie's sophomore year. It was 1977. Greg Manning for Steel High.
He wrote one about Greg Manning.
Okay. Yeah.
He wrote
one. And they played Reading, I think, four times that year, the last of which was in the district final, and it went three or four overtimes. That was Rosignoli.
Yeah.
That was Rosignoli and Crystal, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And that went three or four overtimes, and Reading won it. But Steel High.
63.
Okay. Wow.
I'll give you all the details.
Wow.
That's great.
They played four times. They played four times that year, right? Because they were both in the Central Penn Conference.
Yep.
Steelton beat them twice during the regular season.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the District 3 final, Reading beat them 65-63 on Pete Mullenberg's jumper at the buzzer of the third overtime. Then they played again in the inner districts, and Steelton beat them again.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think it was 65-53.
That might have
been. The next year, Reading won. They repeated. They won District 3 again.
Yeah.
They beat Harrisburg 30-27.
It was
just an unbelievable game because they just They just were so patient, and they waited for the back door, and they won 30-27 because Harrisburg had a, you know, had a team that wanted to get up and down and up and down, and Reading just slowed them up and won that game.
Now I have Pete Muhlenberg trivia. He got drafted by the Sixers.
Delaware was the last pick in the 10th round.
He was Mr. Irrelevant, yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
How about that?
Gotta love it. Gotta love it.
I'm telling you, I this is my life.
would you remember, I don't know if,
kind of stuff.
I don't know, this might have been right before you got to FNM, but 1 year FNM and Widener played a 38-37 game where Joe Straining went the length of the court and laid it in at the buzzer. Obviously pre-shot clock, but it reminds me of that kind of game, you know, where every possession is just...
That was my sophomore year.
Mm-hmm.
Straining was starting, but I was playing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I was 0-5. I didn't play. I was terrible that night, actually. But I probably blamed it on Glenn. I remember I was 0-5 that game off the bench. I didn't make a shot.
Right.
But I'll never forget the timeout. The timeout before, I think they had a foul shot or something. I said to Joe Straining, I was like, go. Just go. Because I think he only had like 5 seconds.
Yeah.
But he was really fast. Mm-hmm. He could really get the ball up the court,
mm-hmm.
and I was just like, just go, because I knew if he tried to make a pass, just go to the basket, see what happens. And I think he made it left-handed.
I don't remember that part, but it's pretty sound strategy because you know they don't want to foul, so just go to the rim.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
Yeah, I could still kind of. Exactly. I think that was like a Saturday afternoon game, if memory serves. That was
You're
quite.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Because I remember the night. I remember the night after the game. It was a lot of fun.
I bet it was.
Hey, man. We presume you have a life to get to, and we're going to let you do it. We're going to let you do it. Really enjoyed it, man.
Like I said, this is kind of my life, guys. So it's no bother at all. I enjoy it.
Yeah, enjoy it very much, and I hope you keep on doing these entries because I think they're all really well done, and they just touch a lot of chords, I think, as far as anybody who likes the game.
Thank you, I appreciate that, guys.
So
thanks, Matt.
Wish you the best. Well. Take care. Be well.
Bye, man. And yes, absolutely. Talk to you soon.
All right. See you soon. Matt Steinmetz, ladies and gentlemen. he was a hell of a player, but yeah, he was a hard-headed kid, and he kind of admitted that when he was there, it wasn't always pretty with him and Glenn, but it's kind of the same thing that Penn State players said about Paterno. The older they got, the smarter he got, and it seems like that's the same thing that happened with Matt and Glenn.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know that Glenn was, I don't know, I necessarily describe him as old school from an X and O standpoint necessarily.
No.
I mean, he was a Dean Smith guy, and Dean Smith was sort of cutting edge
as
far as X and O stuff. But, Glenn just really wanted to win. He just really wanted to win and had high standards, and that's what it was.
And Matt was a hell of a player there, and so it's neat. I love these essays. If anybody wants to read them, they're on mattsteinmetz.com. They're all really well done. Like I said, there's one about Greg Manning. There's one about Chris Mullen, which is kind of interesting. There's one about Pete Carril, which is kind of a funny scene because the way Matt describes it is his mom picks him up at basketball camp, and his mom asks him, "Well, what did you learn at camp today?" And young Matt Steinmetz goes, "Don't fuck the dog," which is apparently the advice that Pete Carril gave the young lads at this camp, which was...
Red flag up for mom. Man.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm guessing mom partially drove off the road.
I don't know the timing of when Carril left Reading.
I don't remember.
Because I don't remember him being at... Like, that team that went to the state final was Stu Jackson.
Yeah.
That was Gano.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it around maybe like very early 70s?
Let's look. Bear with me while I...
While he went...
Reading High School from 1958 to 1966.
Oh, 66. Okay, yeah. So that's way back.
Yeah.
And Matt is younger than us, so this was after... Kirill was gone when he was doing these camps and stuff.
I guess
gone from Reading, huh?
Yeah, because he was at Lehigh in 66 and 67, and then obviously he was at Princeton from 67 to 96.
Yeah, so I knew he had been at Lehigh, but very briefly. It was pretty much right from Reading High to pretty high-level college coaching, which is impossible today.
Yeah.
I mean, that will...
I forget who wrote this, but somebody wrote a story for the late, great National Sports Daily about Pete Carril. And I remember the lead, and Pete Carril went into this long story.
I remember the story.
Yeah.
I remember the story.
I can't remember who wrote it, though, because it was so good. And it was like, he went into this long story, and I forget the particulars of it, but finally he said, what was I talking about? Because he went on some tangent. He goes, you're talking about doing more with less, which was such a wonderful lead.
Yeah.
And I got to go back and find that story. Because
I remember that story. I think I still have, up in the attic somewhere, like two copies of that National Sports
Daily.
I used to subscribe to it.
Yeah.
That was such a cool thing, I thought.
Right, it was.
And that was one of them. That was one of the two issues that I still have. I was just upstairs... just up in that attic. Oh my God, what a scene! And I'm thinking we need to maybe do like spring cleaning and get rid of a bunch of crap.
No,
and I'm kind of interested to see some of the things that some of the written material, maybe that I wrote over the years, and but also those two copies of the National that I.
There's something about sports writers, I think, that makes us unbearable pack rats, because every time Barb wants to throw some of my stuff out, I tell her it's vital information.
Oh, vital.
You never know when you might need it.
I have a 2008 Notre Dame basketball media.
Because you never know.
I don't know why I have it. You never know.
You never know.
And we used to have, remember the Intel had tons of those.
Yes.
The Lancaster paper that we used to work for.
Yes.
And, you know, online kind of made 90% of that irrelevant.
Exactly.
But,
yeah, I mean, because I remember going to Sixers games and you'd pack like the NBA guide and the NBA register and your bag weighed like 8 tons.
Yeah.
And now it's like you don't need any of that.
You don't need any of that, which is actually, from a practical standpoint, a good thing, because you can find, like Matt's saying, I found the specific game on Basketball Reference.
Yeah, so I'm glad he's doing it. And to me, you know, his point about not being able to write a book, to me this would be a good book for people in, you know, maybe especially this area, where you just go in and you like pick and choose and say, oh, look at this.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, don't you wonder if a really curated selection of your own work over the years would make an interesting book?
Mine probably not.
Come on, big guy. I do. I mean, the best of my stuff, I'm not deluded enough to think most of my stuff is good or great, but I think some of it is, and some of it is could be put together in a way that would tell a story a little bit about sports writing and about sports and
maybe so. It's an interesting thought. It really is, because you're right, because it's like, you know, you don't hit a home run every day, but every now and then you do.
And you
know it when you do.
And I do less frequently now, but for sure. But so I appreciate it more when I do. Yeah, that would be an interesting. Maybe that's a project that I'll do when I.
I like the
step
idea.
Off the,
before you shuffle off this mortal coil.
Step off the roller coaster.
anyway, we wanted to go on and we wanted to talk a little bit about NCAA since it is Selection Sunday this Sunday. And
yep.
I think maybe I've watched one college game all year, so I'm far.
Oh, wow. Haven't watched as much as I used to, but I haven't.
Far from well equipped for this discussion, let's say. But at any rate, I pulled up Joe Lunardi's proposed brackets right now, and he has Kansas, Alabama, UCLA, and Houston as the top seeds. Mike, what say you about what's going on?
Well, first, I want to say, isn't Joe Lunardi's career interesting?
Yes.
This is I think he is or was the sports information director at St. Joe's.
Yeah, I know he was. I know he might. It was on the radio. I'm not sure if he was there. But whatever. It has some.
And he became this national figure because of bracketology,
which wasn't even a thing like 30 years ago.
A term that didn't exist not that long ago. Anyway, you know, I haven't watched a ton this year. I feel like a month ago I would have said this is the first year I can ever remember where if any team lost in the tournament, it would not be a shock to you.
Right.
I mean, you know, like Purdue's been a really good team all year, but if they lost, I think that's changing a little. Mm-hmm. Kansas seems like they're playing really well. They've been consistent all year, and they're winning. They're going on the road in what has become a very good conference, maybe the best conference.
Interesting.
In the country. They've gone on the road and won a lot of games, and they're like 27-5 or something. Mm-hmm. I think Duke is starting to come a little bit after not having a good year at all.
No, not really.
And they're young, but I think they're starting to come, and they thumped Pitt, which has had a pretty good year in the ACC tournament today, by 30.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're coming a little bit. Gonzaga, I thought, made a statement the other night after really not having a very good year at all. And kind of seeming like they maybe had taken a step back in comparison to St. Mary's in their league.
Mm-hmm.
And they just destroyed St. Mary's in the championship game of their conference tournament the other night. And there's a couple others like that. Kentucky has played better the last month.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if they've really figured it out. UCLA is a very solid team.
Yeah, I like that big guy that I have.
Yeah, I do too.
He's a good player. He's very sound.
Yeah. I like him a lot, and the point guard is very good, and they got athletes, and they have a very unpleasant man as their coach.
Mick Cronin.
maybe he's not as unpleasant as he appears to be, but I like their team a lot. I think they would be one of my finals.
Well, what about this? According to Lenardi, the Penn State is among the last four in, and North Carolina is among the first four out. Now, that's not many years you can say that.
That's for sure. Remember Penn State under Parkhill beating North Carolina in the tournament?
Yes.
I can't remember what year that was, but anyway, North Carolina, which went to the championship game last year.
Yeah, leading by 15.5.
And should have won the national championship. And I don't think they deserve to be in the tournament as it stands now. If they make a run in the conference tournament, maybe get to the final of that, I would say. Otherwise, they're not even in the tournament. That's a mystery. They're an exception to that thing I was just saying about the powers kind of figuring it out lately. They have not.
Yeah, so I don't know what happens when they play Virginia tonight as we speak. So that'll be an interesting test because they beat Virginia at North Carolina in the most recent meeting of the two teams. But I suspect that's probably for Carolina's tournament life.
I think so, yeah. And Penn State right now is playing Illinois in the Big Ten tournament in Chicago. And if they lose that game, they become very marginal. They're probably more likely out than in if they lose that game. And they already beat Illinois twice.
Mm-hmm.
So this will be that old thing about it's tough to beat a team three times in 1 year. I don't know if I buy that, but that's
One of those things. We should talk about basketball truisms. Why? Why would it be so difficult to beat a team three times? Yeah. Why?
I don't think it really is. I think that's... people would think, well, if they're good...
Yeah,
it's just hard to beat them over and over, and people adjust and all that. But I don't think that's necessarily.
Or here's another one: press a pressing team. Why?
Yeah, I don't know. That was an Al McGuire.
That was
favorite.
An Al McGuire.
That was an Al McGuire favorite, and he must have. He was a great coach for a long time. Maybe he was not a press guy.
Mm-hmm.
He liked to walk it up and play a very disciplined style, and so maybe he had some. First-hand evidence, I don't know.
Yeah, but it's interesting to me how these things get ingrained, and it's like,
yeah,
well, are they just true because we repeat them?
Here's a good example of this from baseball. This is one of the early Bill James things that I remember. Stan Musial was doing an interview 100 years ago, and somebody asked him, what do you think is the real prime of a baseball player? And he guessed... I'd say age 28 to 32, which is provable, demonstrably false. It's younger than that. It's roughly like 26 to 29 is the prime of a baseball player, demonstrably so. That's objectively true.
Mm-hmm.
But this 28 to 32 thing, for decades, was...
Because Stan... Hey, who are we to go against Stan the Man?
Well, yeah, that's true. Stan the Man, awesome. He is awesome. Tremendous. He was.
Yeah, he was.
But, come on. It's one of those things. It's one of those things that just settles into the culture of a sport or anything.
Right. Should we talk about quarterbacks? I mean, apparently Aaron Rodgers is close to being traded to the Jets. I mean, that's been the story the last few days, and there is further reporting along those lines now. to me, that makes a lot of sense. As a Packers fan, I salute the career he's had to date. He's been a wonderful player, but all things must come to an end. And the from a practical standpoint, from a franchise standpoint, if you hang on to him, which some people have suggested, including Aaron Jones, one of their better players, that he should come back, well, no, because eventually you're not going to have Rodgers or his successor, Jordan Love. It's just from a practical standpoint.
Yeah, and you understand why a guy like that is saying that, but right. That's not the way you can think if you're running a team.
No, you got to turn the page. I mean, it's just like, you know, no hard feelings, but it's just like it's time.
I make the mistake almost every morning of watching ESPN's and my wife, who is often puttering around while this is on, the other day said, "Man, I am really getting sick of hearing about Aaron Rodgers." I mean, she's just totally in her periphery. But they just beat NFL quarterbacks to death day after day after day. It's impossible to overstate how much they beat it.
Yeah, true.
Lately, it's been Aaron Rodgers and Lamar Jackson every single day. So I tend to roll my eyes a little bit. But both of their situations are kind of interesting, really.
I think so. Yeah. It's because it's like the whole what can the Packers get, especially given the fact that he's almost 40 and he's making $60 million a year. I mean, what do you get in compensation for a guy like that? I suspect that's the hardest part of this right now.
Yeah, that's what they're working on right now. But I sort of feel like it's starting to feel like it's going
to
happen.
Yeah, that seems to be where the reporting is right now, that it's going to happen. It's just a matter of, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's. As for Lamar Jackson, he's an odd player to me. I mean, he is a surpassing athlete, one of the best athletes in the NFL. But is he a good quarterback? I question that.
I think he's pretty good, but I think he's a little bit overrated. Yeah. I think, again, going back to this ESPN morning show, these guys talk about him like he's this transcendent player. And I don't think he quite is. And it's a very interesting situation because he wants guaranteed money.
Mm-hmm.
And there's now some precedent for it because Cleveland gave Deshaun Watson, despite his problems off the field, a huge guaranteed deal because that's what they had to do in order to make that happen, right? I mean, so now that's what he wants. And the other thing that only in the last couple of days have people been starting to bring this up, which I think is an issue here. Lamar Jackson has never had an agent.
Yeah, his mom is sort of his agent.
His mom is sort of, no, you can't. I mean, this is big time sports business stuff.
No, I'm
sitting here listening to this discussion thinking, is nobody going to bring this up? This dude doesn't have an agent? I mean, and he's trying to do this record-setting, this precedent-setting thing in the NFL of all monstrous sports entities, and he doesn't have an agent? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those situations where his mom was, you know, raised him as a single parent and apparently she was a great athlete herself. And so as far as, you know, working him out when he was growing up, she was very much involved in that. But this is way beyond her depth. Yeah. Obviously.
Yeah. As David Letterman used to say about Larry Bud Melman, he is not an attorney. Well, Lamar Jackson, your mom, is not an attorney.
This just in. So I'm really kind of curious about how that plays itself. I mean, to me, the most sensible thing is Baltimore, because they pretty much built their whole team to suit his strengths.
I was just about to say that. Great minds are you have to, if you go all in with him, that means changing your offense almost certainly, substantially, and playing differently than almost every other team.
Yeah, it's playing almost a collegiate kind of offense.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And it's worked pretty well for them. But although he's had some real clunkers in the playoffs too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's worked pretty well, but it's been, I mean, the Ravens have been a really good organization and have been relatively successful for a long time. They're almost analogous to the Steelers a little bit. In the long term, they're well run. The ceiling is, I mean, the floor is pretty high for what they do year after year, and they really haven't,
Lamar Jackson's tenure has not been an outlier. It's been just what they've been doing for many years.
Yeah. So it is an impressively run organization, for sure. Yeah, that's for quite a while now.
And the head coach has been there for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying does that get stale eventually?
No.
I mean, I'm not down on him at all, but, you know, there's a lot of things going on.
Yeah, he's really been one of Jackson's foremost advocates. I mean, who knows how genuine that is? Or who knows whether he's playing to the cameras, but he certainly, we're speaking of John Harbaugh, their head coach.
And in a lot of his public utterances, Jackson has been relatively pro Ravens. Now, there have been some times when he's kind of thinly veiled. Things about, well, if you really care about me, you'll do, whatever.
All right, so we wanted to end with tomorrow night the PIAA tournament begins, and you will be covering Mannheim Central, which finished second in the district. Who do you think's, I mean, you've always talked about Lancaster Mennonite, and they've obviously had a lot of success this time of year. I mean, do you think they're going to be the last ones standing from our league?
Or? Well, it could. You know who it could be is this Linville Hill Christian. Now, they're not in our league. They're from Lancaster County. But they're Class A, and they're coached by Mike Schatzman, who is a longtime basketball guy around here, played at coached at Pequot Valley. His son was a pretty good college player at Eton. Anyway.
Yeah.
They're very, for Class A, they're remarkably big and athletic.
That'll work.
Class A. It's so many of these Christian schools that you've never heard of. And little schools, I mean, Jerry Johnson's Law Academia is in there slugging at 12 and 11 in the year. And that's by no means the worst record of teams that are still playing. But anyway, they might be the one that has a puncher's chance to keep playing. Yeah. Mannheim Central is Class 5A, and that's Imhotep, and Imhotep is going to win that state championship, and if they don't, it will be the biggest upset in the history of sports.
Yeah, well, we were both at the district championship game last week with Exeter and Mannheim Central, and Central, I mean, they're impressive. They're obviously well-coached. They play hard. They play together, but I don't think they have the firepower to hang around a long time. I mean,
this might be a winnable game for them tomorrow night, and on Saturday I'll be seeing Hempfield against Emmaus from the Allentown area. And I think that's probably a winnable game for Hempfield. But again, you look at some of these teams, Reading, they're in 6A. Hempfield is in 6A. Reading, Roman Catholic, which won the Philadelphia Catholic League, which that's like winning the SEC. in this context. So, the Philadelphia area is incredibly dominant. It's funny how it's like 16, 18 years ago now that they got in this thing, and for a couple of years they didn't do much.
Isn't that weird?
It's weird to think about. It seemed like there was an adjustment period, but they are really dominant now.
Yeah. There you have it. So we'll look forward to that over these next few days and weeks, and before long it'll be spring sports, although it doesn't feel like it right now weather-wise, we'll be there.
We'll be there.
Anyway, I think there's anything else for the good of the order, Mike.
Well, I want to use the term haunting and lyrical one more time.
I wanted to say that our thanks to Todd Fulgenetti. He is the one who came up with the After the Buzzer theme song that you will be hearing from now on. So many thanks to him, and we'll move
forward.
That's it.
He's Gordy. I'm Mike. See ya.
See ya later.